Hello and welcome to Shattered Lives, Reach Ireland's crime podcast. I'm Paul Healy. I'm crime correspondent for the Irish Daily Star and Irish Mirror. And I'm joined, as always, by Michael O'Toole, our crime and defence editor, on what is a great day to be a crime correspondent because, knock on wood, we can put our feet up to a degree because, obviously, a massive political bombshell today. We know nothing about politics, so don't worry, we're not going to talk about it. Just mentioning that today is the day that Leo Varadkar has sensationally resigned, which nobody saw coming. I thought you were going to jump in there with your political opinions, Mick.
I don't do opinions, but I was going to say, it's like I always say to the lads in work, budget day is a great day for a crime corps because it's all everything else. So this is another day where we can hopefully put our feet up. The only way it could possibly impact on crime, I will say, is if Helen McEntee goes for it, becomes Taoiseach, and there's a knock-on effect there. But I don't think that's likely. I think she wouldn't be one of the favourites.
No, there's a time she was definitely mooted as a potential future leader, but I think she's had quite a number of controversies that might keep her away from that particular office, and there's a lot to do in the Department of Justice, so I'd say she'd be staying there, but watch this space. But anyway, we're not here to talk about politics, because what do we know about politics? So we're going to talk about what we know about, which is crime, and there has been plenty of crime-related news over the last couple of days, and in particular over the bank holiday weekend. I just want to mention, obviously, first, the latest fatality that's being investigated by Gardaí, that is in Cove, and you were across that, Mick.
Yeah, it's a horrific case, Paul. I think there's a post-mortem underway in Cork University Hospital as we speak. And as the guards always say, the results of that post-mortem will decide the direction of the Garda investigation. In other words, whether it'll be upgraded to a murder inquiry. I'd say it probably will because it was particularly horrible. Essentially what happened, there was a young chef down there by the name of Ian Bateson, 33-year-old young father. It appears he was targeted by someone he knew. The suspicion would be that someone may have been involved in a dispute over money. Somebody may have wanted a few quid off him. And essentially what happened on Friday evening, he was in a shop in Cove when he was spotted by this suspect, shall we say. And the suspect is alleged to have waited outside or waited nearby for Mr. Bateson coming out of the shop. And then he attacked him in a car park in the centre of Cove. Now, Gardaí would believe that he used a heavy sword or machete type blade, really, really dangerous, and he attacked him in the leg, and Mr. Bateson, God love him, he suffered significant injuries, and he lost a significant amount of blood at the scene. Now, I think there was a passerby who administered life-saving first aid, because I think he was very close to death. Were it not for the actions of that passerby, who I think was a nurse or a paramedic, just happened to be passing, managed to stabilise him, and he was rushed to hospital, but he had lost a huge amount of blood. I think, I don't know if they applied a tourniquet, but you know, they did something like that because they cut an artery in the attack, basically. So, you know, he was rushed to CUH, and unfortunately he lost his fight for life on Tuesday. It had been looking very bad for him. I think, you know, the Gardaí had been braced for Mr. Bateson losing his life, and that is what happened. But a terrible disaster. I think, you know, sources would say, obviously he was attacked, but it was a question of did the attacker or attackers mean to kill him? Probably not. But if you attack somebody with a sword and you swipe at their leg, there's obviously a very dangerous risk to someone's life, and that's what happened in this case. But I think it will, the investigation will progress pretty quickly. I know there was a search in Cove yesterday, and I think they would have a good picture on who they're looking for, I'll put it that way.
So the status of the investigation at the moment, it's not a murder investigation currently, is it?
No, it hasn't been upgraded as we speak. There's a post-mortem on today. Look, the guards will probably release another press release about this later on this evening. If it's not a murder inquiry, it'll be the equivalent or the status of a murder inquiry. In other words, it'll be 30 or 40 officers involved in this. It's a very, very serious investigation. A man has lost his life.
Absolutely. Well, we'll keep following that one. We want to speak, obviously, about the death of Pearse McCauley, Garda killer and wife beater. This is one of those stories that broke late in the evening. It's worth talking about that, because sometimes I wonder whether people know how we get stories, and in particular when it comes to when you hear a rumor that someone has died, you really have to be sure and double sure and triple sure that that person is dead. Now, this guy's a scumbag, worst of the worst, a criminal. As I said, he shot and killed Detective Garda Jerry McCabe in that infamous post office robbery in Adair, 1996. He served time for that, and then he subsequently served a lengthy period for beating his ex-wife, the Sinn Féin TD, Pauline Tully. So a thug through and through, ex-Provo, once very popular with Sinn Féin, an infamous figure in gangland crime. But we had to be double, triple sure. We both heard it, and we both checked it, and ultimately confirmed that Pearse McCauley had died in Strabane, apparently of natural causes. Seems he died of a heart attack. Mm-hmm. And he died alone. And what I was told early on, I don't think the information has changed, is that it seems like he might have even been dead in this property for a number of days. So very much a sad, a pathetic end to his life. But he's someone you certainly have a lot of prior experience in dealing with.
Yes, so it's really hard to underestimate how cataclysmic June 1996 was, because you had the murder of Jerry McCabe. He wasn't the IRA gang were not they were charged with the murder, but they pleaded guilty to manslaughter, served 10 and a half years. But it was cataclysmic that month, because later that month Veronica Guerin was murdered. So I remember just a sense of shock, really. First Garda, Detective Garda Jerry McCabe, and then our late colleague Veronica Guerin. So both killings, both murders, had a tremendous effect on the people and on the state, really. And we know what happened with the Gilligan gang that murdered Veronica Guerin. There was also a massive Garda investigation into the IRA murder of Detective Garda McCabe, and it really did become a real long-running saga, because there was the hunt for them. ERU were involved in arresting a man called Kevin Walsh, who was central to the gang. He was jailed along with Pearse McCauley. He was arrested up around Cavan, Monaghan area. ERU raided a farmhouse, and he was lying on the bed with a Kalashnikov beside the bed, and it was ready for use. So it was real high-stakes stuff, and the ERU basically scrambled for the Kalashnikov while they raided the place. So they were regarded, now this is what Republicans would say, don't shoot the messenger, people, I'm only saying that they were, that unit, McCauley and Kevin Walsh and the others, that was very, very, within Republicanism, was a very well regarded IRA unit. They were regarded as sort of, not like the A-team, but you know, really elite within the IRA. Again, these aren't my views, I'm just telling you what, and they were very, very well got within the IRA. We can't deny that, that's what happened, and there was a really strong campaign to get them out of prison. So they were jailed, I think it was 1999, and they got 14 years. They were released in 2009 from Castlereagh Prison in County Roscommon. I was down at it with a couple of other hacks, and it was like a military operation. Martin Ferris was there to welcome Pearse McCauley and Kevin Walsh out. They were driven away, and it was like you see it in the movies. We were following them, driving down all these Barines and everything. It was real, you know, crack basically. But then a van pulled across just under, I always remember, a wee isolated road just under a bridge, and a van pulled across and stopped us, and we were stymied, we couldn't go backwards or forward, had to sit there and watch them drive off into the sunset. Martin Ferris made no apology for taking them away. He defended himself. He was the Kerry TD at the time for Sinn Féin. So it really did dominate the headlines for a long time, because Sinn Féin made repeated attempts to try and get the men released under the Good Friday Agreement. And the government steadfastly refused to do that. And they didn't. They didn't get released under the Good Friday Agreement. They did. They got 14 years and they served 10 and a half. So you and I will know remission. They just got normal 25% remission along with everybody else. But it really was a massive story. And it was a story that rumbled on for years and years, because there were pictures of them. They were in the Grove part of Castlereagh Prison. They had their own bungalow, basically. And there were photographs of them, there were lots of visitors and stuff. So it was one of those stories that was always there. We kept on coming back to, you know. But then they got released. And then late 2014, he committed this horrific attack on Deputy Tully.
Obviously, then he after his release, he went on to marry Pauline Tully, Sinn Féin TD. But as mentioned, that marriage ultimately broke down, and he called to her door one night and brutally assaulted and stabbed her, and she was very lucky not to be killed by him. And he was sentenced to, I'm going to say, another 14 years in prison for that. So,
yeah, I think that was December 2014. I remember I was working. It was around Christmas time, 2014.
Christmas Eve.
It was a Christmas Eve. It was a particularly horrific attack. And I think you're right. I think it's fair to say she did fear for her life. And I remember, you know, he was running through the fields. And if memory serves me right, he resisted arrest. So the guards had to use force to restrain him. So he obviously was extremely violent. And I was just talking to somebody the other day about him who would have met him. He did have an aura of violence about him. Now, as I say, he was very well regarded within the Republican movement, but I think the attack on Miss Tully changed things for an awful lot of Republicans. Because that was a, you know, and you know, I know people will say, okay, so it's okay. People supported him when he was involved in the murder of Detective Gardner McCabe, and he was involved, like he was involved in a prison escape in Brixton. I remember it in 1991. You know, he was regarded as a hero within the Republican movement. So it's okay, you can kill British soldiers, or if he did, or you can be involved in attacks, you can murder a Detective Garda. That's okay, that's part of the struggle, but you can't do this. So, but that's, look, I'm only explaining what it is. I'm only explaining how well regarded he was.
I'm coming in on this at the end of his sort of story, but certainly the sense I'm getting is that he is totally rejected by the majority of Republicans and people in Sinn Féin. There are some people who stand by him and support him even still in Republican circles, but a very, very small number now. But it is shocking, and not to make too much of a political commentary, but I suppose maybe it's indicative of the times. I mean, certainly you can't imagine now Sinn Féin standing by anybody like that in a public manner, but I don't know what it was about the time period. What was their excuse for standing by someone who had taken the life of a Garda?
Right. This is, I'm not going to give you a history lesson, right? But, you know, Paul, as I always say, context is everything, Republicans can rationalise, and Republicans can, to a certain extent, you know, they would say that it was indefensible what happened, but they did try to contextualise it. Now, they will say there was a war on. People disagree with that. I'm sitting here going, don't shoot the messenger, but that is, they regarded themselves in a war against the British. Now, there is the Green Book, when you're not allowed to engage, as they would say, state forces down here, what they would call 26 county forces. So the defence forces are in Garda Síochána, but there have been several. We know Patrick Kelly, we know private recruit Garda Gary Sheehan. There have been several Gardaí murdered by Republicans during the Troubles. And I just think that they just regarded it, look, from their perspective, this was a war and bad things happened in war. I think most people would disagree with that, but
they
were
robbing a post office, you know. But anyway, yeah, I suppose it was different times. But
I'll just contextualise it in this respect: that the Southern Command, obviously, it's not all of the Republic, because some of the Ulster counties and the border counties were part of Northern Command in the area. But Southern Command was very much involved in logistics and raising money. So, in other words, bank robberies to fund what they called their war.
Oh, fascinating. I want to briefly mention it just in terms of when the name came up for something that I covered, people might remember in the trial of Gerry the Monk Hutch, Special Criminal Court trial, he was accused of the murder of David Byrne, and obviously, as everyone knows, probably he was acquitted of that crime. But the name Piers McCauley came up in relation to Jonathan Dowdall, the former Sinn Féin politician, and I suppose you'd call him a Republican, although even he is rejected by most people in Republican circles. But supposedly Jonathan Dowdall, on behalf of what Gardaí would term the Hutch organised crime group, went to visit Piers McCauley a total of 14 times when he was in Castlereagh prison. And people might remember the showdown between Brendan Gretton and Jonathan Dowdall, and this was one of the things that Mr. Gretton actually challenged Dowdall on, because Dowdall was trying to play down the connection to Piers McCauley and exactly the relevance of it. But I remember that the record of all the prison visits were put to him, and it was shown that he had visited him 14 times, and effectively Dowdall was looking for help from dissident Republicans, including the then jailed Piers McCauley, to try and have the AK-47s that were used in the Regency attack transferred, given as a present, whatever way you want they phrased it, but also to try and have Gerry Hutch meet with dissident Republicans who might be able to help him in the feud. The way Dowdall termed it is that he was helping Jared Hutch to try and negotiate a peace process, and people might remember that Gerry Hutch was driven by Jonathan Dowdall up north and met with Shane Roan, and supposedly that meeting was all facilitated by Piers McCauley. So later in his life, that's what he was doing. He was meeting the likes of Jonathan Dowdall and getting into bed with the Hutch gang and facilitating them in the Kinahan Hutch feud.
And do you remember when I was talking earlier about how well regarded he was within Republicanism? When these meetings, 14 meetings happened, he was in prison for the attack on Deputy Tully. So, but people still went to him, and if he facilitated that meetings, it sort of proves my point that people did have regard for him still, despite what he did. That horrendous crime against Deputy Tully, and despite the horrendous murder of Detective Garda McCabe. So, you mentioned earlier about the funeral.
Yes.
I wonder, will Republicans turn up at that? I suspect some will.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, there are some people, okay, in lesser roles, but I've seen a councillor, for example, paying tribute to him. I won't name the person. So there are people who openly still laud him and think of him as a Republican hero. How many will be brave enough to show their face? We'll have to see.
People are very good at contextualising things and, you know, looking at it and going, well, I know despite that I'm going to go, or despite that I'm going to do this. So I would expect, I don't know how senior the Republicans be, but I would expect there'll definitely be former IRA volunteers at that. I have very little doubt about that.
We'll watch that with interest. So we move on, because we've got lots more to talk about. I feel like the moderator, but I am kind of playing that role. not my intention, but let's talk about the ongoing investigation into alleged corruption, Garda corruption, and there are three people before the court, so we're playing this relatively straight, because as we often mention on this podcast, when things are sub judice, meaning that before the courts, we've got to stick to the court reporting. So the latest individual that has been charged in relation to this ongoing investigation into corruption is a Stephen Wren, and he's a former Dublin City Councillor, and he was in Dublin District Court today charged over the production of Garda search warrants for two addresses. So he's the third person to be charged. The anti-corruption unit are leading this investigation. But you've dealt with two of those particular cases, Mick.
Yeah, so the guards have issued a statement saying that four Gardaí have been suspended as part of an investigation by the anti-corruption unit into a certain Garda unit in the what we call the DMR, the Dublin Metropolitan Region. They haven't named it, but we do know that there are four Gardaí suspended. Now, two Gardaí have appeared in court, and Stephen Wren, who is a peace commissioner and was also a Dublin City Council councillor for Labour, he appeared in court today. He's the third person charged. So two Gardaí and Mr. Rendo. He's charged with four offences, two of forgery and two of furt in the course of justice. Now, the court did hear that his case has been adjourned until the 7th of May. He was charged last on the 12th of March at Clontarf Garda Station, and the court heard today that he made no reply when the charges were put to him. So the case has been put back to the 7th of May. The two Gardaí, Kieran Whelan, who's a sergeant, and Garda Mark Duffy, both appeared earlier. I was in court on Tuesday for Sergeant Kieran Whelan. Now, he has an address in Nene. He's 51-year-old, and he is facing seven charges, including one of false imprisonment, perverting the course of justice, four of Brit in the Course of Justice and two of burglary. And Garda Mark Duffy is facing, he appeared in court last week. His address is in West Dublin, and he is facing one charge of a Brit in the Course of Justice and one case of burglary. Now, in those cases, both men, although they appeared initially separately, they have both been remanded on continuing bail until the 17th of May, when there will be DPP's direction. So in both cases, the DPP has directed, or the DPP we know already has directed judge and jury trial, so that's an indictment. So obviously that's a higher sentencing upon conviction, if there is a conviction. But as we said, Gardaí did say four. Gardaí have been suspended as part of this investigation into a unit, and they did. The guards do stress every time there is an appearance or a press release that the unit is continuing its work by other Gardaí.
Right, we unfortunately probably have to leave it there because matters are before the courts. But in general, the issue of, you know, whether crime correspondents are choosy about, you know, certain subjects, and we're not willing to go there when it comes to members of the judiciary or an Garda Síochána or whatever being charged with an offence, that's certainly not true. And you're seeing an awful lot of examples in more recent times of people from all sectors of society being charged with crimes, and it's gotten plenty of press attention. So, and one such case that I want to mention just briefly, because I'm sure it's been all over the news and people are aware of it, but I just want to commend Maeve Doyle, Maeve McLaughlin Doyle, for coming forward and telling her story and ultimately going before the courts and getting her ex-husband Mark Doyle charged for several counts of assault causing harm to her and her children over 12 years. So a litany of abuse and domestic violence. But Mark Doyle was a Garda, a member of an Garda Síochána. You know, she must have felt a terrible, and she did, she told me herself, fear in coming forward, that added fear, not just because this person, she was terrified of him and he was her husband, but also he wore that uniform and he used it as a weapon against her. And Mark Doyle was someone who was respected within the community and even among fellow members of an Garda Síochána. And Maeve had told me that effectively she felt as though no one would believe her, that he painted her as sort of a ditzy kind of crazy person, always made out to people that they knew that he was nearly the victim of psychological abuse. So she struggled for many years, but she finally came forward and she got justice there last week. And former Garda Mark Doyle was jailed for 6 years. And particularly want to mention, you know, the fact that this is something that members of an Garda Síochána are disgusted by and have come out and rallied in support of Maeve McLaughlin Doyle. And it's great to see. And even when Maeve went out onto the steps of the Criminal Court of Justice there last Friday, she was supported by family, friends, but members of an Garda Síochána, and even, I will say, the Garda Press Office even had a presence there. It was important for them to highlight this issue and to show that, look, this is something that is reviled by fellow Gardaí. They want to root out bad cops. They don't support this in any way. They don't condone it. And that they want to throw their support behind someone like Maeve McLaughlin Doyle, because domestic violence happens in every scenario. And it's particularly sinister when someone like this, who's in a position of quote-unquote authority, uses that then as a weapon, or even can think they're untouchable, they're outside of the law.
So, yeah, a lot of people have made comments about, you know, Gardaí going after Gardaí. So I've been doing this in the Star since March 2000, and I was thinking about this because I'm not making any comment about any existing cases, but say when the anti-corruption unit was set up, and that was, I think it was 2019, right? Before that, the National Bureau of Criminal Investigation, the NBCI, and before that, the CDU, the Central Detective Unit, before the NBCI was formed, they went after bad cops. They did. Now, and I've probably covered, I'd say it's probably easily 20 Gardaí who have been hunted down and prosecuted by other Gardaí. And not once, for various things, child abuse imagery, trying to procure, freaking rape children, you know, lots of things, really, really serious crimes. I've never once heard any guard go, the poor devil. It's always been, fuck him. And it is mostly men. So I, with Mark Doyle, I think it's fair to say there has been zero sympathy or anything from any guard that I've been speaking to about this fella. They're glad he's gone, and they're glad he's done. Would you find that as well, that people you're speaking to
have zero sympathy? And there's complete support for Maeve. And I just want to point out a couple of things that she said to me. I was lucky enough to interview Maeve over the weekend, and we went, I think we put it on our front page actually, on Bank Holiday Monday. She was very giving of her time. She's an incredibly brave person to come forward and speak even outside the courts, just to a gaggle of media, but then to let alone do an interview with myself, and I'm sure she's going to do further interviews and speak out. And she says she wants to speak out to educate people and also encourage other women to come forward. But I mean, she told me, for example, this is just how he used his position to instill fear in her and her children, that he had weapons all over the house, that he had a rifle, that he had a baseball bat that he kept by the bed. And she lived in this kind of clouded reality where she thought this was normal, until one day she woke up and realized it's far from normal. And she actually referenced a case that people might remember, an infamous murder-suicide case in Cavan, the Haw family, where Alan Haw, a well-respected school deputy principal, murdered his family, that butchered them, really, his wife and his children, and then hung himself. It was a tragic case August 2016.
It was 2016.
And that case, when that happened, that rung a bell with her, she said. And, you know, she looks back now and goes, that could have been her and her kids, because Mark Doyle also abused her kids, viciously assaulted them. And even in one case, one of the boys actually tried to blow the whistle and tell someone in school that he was being assaulted by his stepfather. And ultimately, Mark Doyle comes along in his Garda car, in his uniform, comes up to the school, and again uses his position to basically say, you know, I'm too busy, I don't deserve this, and sure, I'm a good Garda, why would I ever assault my child? And basically made out that the kid was crazy and he was making it all up, and that's what teenagers do. That's the kind of person he was, and that's the kind of fear that they were, that they lived with for 12 years. So, and it's shocking. It's shocking.
It's a complete abuse of what, and he has powers. He did have powers, because, you know, he has the power to stop anybody walking down the street, and that's a tremendous power. And that's a complete abuse of his power, and a complete betrayal of the trust that we as people place in guards.
Mm-hmm. It's a shocking case, but
horrific.
I have to commit. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I just felt, just the copy was really hard to read about the kids, and Maeve as well, but just poor wee kids being in that situation, and any woman and any child being in that situation, it's just, it was really, really upsetting, I have to say.
Yeah, and it's ruined their lives. Like, something Maeve said to me is that she was happy with the sentence, and she ultimately thanked Judge Martin Nolan for imposing it. She thought it was a decent sentence for, I mean, she was expecting less. But when it comes to the children, she said, in particular her eldest, he couldn't bring himself to go to court, because he felt like no matter what Mark Doyle got, it would never be enough. And he basically felt like the last 12 years of his life, which are the formative years of his life, I think he's now an adult, but when he was a child up to a teenager, I think the phrase she used was the Mark Doyle show, that the young lad believed he was just, everything was about Mark Doyle and about him, and he hasn't been able to live his life. So it will never be enough for him.
It's horrific. It is just, and it's just really, really upsetting.
It is, but she's an incredible, as I said, advocate for women. She wants to speak out. She's working with Women's Aid, so hopefully her case inspires others. We'll move on, because we've got a couple more things to talk about. We want to speak about a very different kind of case, which is that of Michael Murray, and he is We could probably do a whole podcast on Michael Murray, so I'm not going to go into every forensic detail of all of his criminal convictions because we could be here all day. But Michael Murray has been basically in prison for most of his adult life. He's committed every crime in the book. He is a convicted rapist. He abducted a child. He has been in for burglary and is also now serving a sentence for threatening to kill two barristers and for harassment. So he has over 40 convictions. He's a very, very serious criminal. But this trial that has just finished has been ongoing for. To get to this process has been going on for years, and that is that he was accused of phoning in a hoax bomb threat against Minister for Justice Helen McEntee from his cell in the Midlands prison. So he was in prison serving his sentence when he made this phone call to the Samaritans charity in May 2021, and the phone call quoted this code word Red October and said that the Minister for Justice's house had bombs planted in it and they were going to go off at 10 o'clock at night, and he made the call sometime around 8:30. Immediately the Samaritans worker, who was terrified, alerted the Gardaí, and all the protocols were followed. Gardaí went out and had to knock on poor Helen McEntee's door. She was pregnant at the time, and they had to search the property. Ultimately found no bombs, thankfully, but they took it very seriously, as they have to. They then commenced an investigation and were able to determine that the phone call was traced back to Michael Murray's cell, and that he was the only person that could have made that phone call. And then Michael Murray basically took the state through a very painful process in which he refused to plead guilty in this case and took it all the way to trial. We had a 7-day trial. A jury was sworn in. You're talking legal aid. I haven't done the maths on it, but several hundreds of thousands of taxpayer money has been spent on this trial, in spite of the fact that Michael Murray admitted to this crime multiple times. And actually, as far as we can tell, firstly to us, actually to this very newspaper that we work for, so he actually admitted to being responsible for the phone call to me in an interview. And how rare is it, Mick, to speak to a prisoner? A prisoner doesn't really get access to a journalist, or shouldn't have access to a journalist, put it that way.
Well, I wouldn't complain if a journalist, if a prisoner got in touch with me. I know what you're saying. I was just talking about this off air. It does happen. I mean, have you ever been? I've certainly been called from prison on burner phones or whatever they have, the wee small phones. But this the interesting thing about this case, this wasn't a burner phone. Mm. I originally, when it happened, I think I broke the story. I thought it was a burner phone, but it was actually he had a phone in his cell that was he needed a pin, so like a landline, shall we say, and he needed a pin to access the phone. And it was after, I thought it was very interesting that the guards worked out, it was after lights out, place was in lockdown, and he was the only person who, as you say, who could have possibly made the phone call, because he was the only person who had access to the phone. But I just thought it was very interesting that he had a phone in his cell. But look, it does happen. I've certainly never turned down anybody calling to me, and you can deduce, they might not even say they're prisoners, and you can work it out. But you know, you've had letters. I've certainly had letters. One, there was an infamous murderer called Mark Desmond, the guinea pig, and he was killed in December 2016. But in the year 2000, he was in custody for a horrendous double murder, the canal double murders, and he wrote me a letter appealing for me to help him get out, that he was an innocent man and everything. So I did meet him afterwards. I did meet him subsequently. Not my smartest moment. Don't need to go into that. I've spoken about it before. But look, it does happen, and people do have a way of getting in contact with you. But I'm just interested in this man, because he fought, as you say, he fought the case everywhere, and he said it was preposterous that he did it, but then he admitted it to you. So he's a bit...
He's deluded, and I think to a certain extent is playing the system, and certainly from speaking to sources who are familiar with him, put it that way, this was very much about putting on a show and about having his 15 minutes of fame, whatever you want to call it, and airing his grievances. And also, he's got nothing better to do. Michael Murray is going to be in prison until at least 2036. And after yesterday, he's been sentenced to another 2 years. He was found guilty ultimately of phoning in this hoax bomb threat. So another 2 years on top of that consecutive. So at least 2037, 2038, he's in prison till. So he's got nothing better to do, is what sources tell me, other than to dream up these incredible plots and to make himself out to be a serious criminal. He has aligned himself with the INLA in the past, and now during his trial mentioned a so-called group called the CRG, which is the Criminal Revenge Group, which he stated he was part of, and mentioned other prisoners. I can't mention one of them because they're actually on trial for something else. And he continually brings up other well-known gangland names and associates himself with them. So I think to a degree, there's a little bit of grandiosity in him. He wants to be seen as this serious criminal and enjoys the limelight for whatever reason. And that's why he contacted me, I believe. I don't want to get into the circumstances of exactly how he contacted me, but nonetheless, I spoke to Michael Murray when he was in his when he was in prison, and that was on the 4th of August 2021, and he was actually ringing me. I was told that he wanted to talk about the fact that he was going on hunger strike, so I opened the conversation with the fact that he was going on hunger strike, and then out of nowhere he said that he was responsible for the phone call threatening the Minister for Justice. It was so unbelievable that I won't repeat line for line here, but I asked him, I think, four or five different ways. You're saying you're responsible, you did it, I did it, I don't give a fuck, that's on the record. Like, blatant, yes, I did it admissions. Despite that, he hadn't yet admitted it to Gardaí. They'd already interviewed him and he denied the whole thing. Obviously, that interview came as a bit of a shock, I would imagine, to investigating Gardaí, or maybe it didn't, given the knowing his track record. 5 days later, Michael Murray met with them in Portlaoise prison, and he then admitted to, and made a statement to them there and then, saying that he was responsible for it. My understanding of it is, when the case progressed, then the guards didn't need our article, didn't need to admit it into evidence, because Michael Murray came to them and admitted it after the fact anyway. So they thought, easy case, this will be done, no problem. But of course, he went on to plead not guilty, took the thing all the way to trial, and I think tried to make a mockery out of the whole system. I don't think it really worked. I mean, in the end, you know, what has he achieved? Another 2 years in prison. Maybe he looks at that and goes, sure, I was going to get time in prison anyway because I'm obviously guilty. I don't really know what his end goal was. But I do feel sorry for the members of Gard Síochána Síochána and the barristers and the jury members and all of the witnesses and that poor Samaritan's worker who had to give evidence, who was completely terrified and obviously didn't want to be involved. All these people got dragged to court over a 7 day period at you and I's expense, because in the end, Murray just wasn't willing to plead guilty.
And you mentioned the barristers and court workers. He did throw a Bible at a judge.
Yes, he has track record for being quite abusive and threw a Bible at a judge in a previous case. I think it's a harassment case. Like that, there you go. That was a harassment case. He was phoning barristers and threatening to kill them. So he has no time for the judiciary at all. And as I said, is phoning in these threats, and even said to me previously that he was going to continue to make threats. So we'll have to see what happens there. But he's a character, is what I would say. Like, even when I covered the trial, the last article I had written about Michael Murray was not flattering. You know, notorious rapist, the whole nine yards. Nonetheless, he waved to me and said hello to me in court, and was passing me notes throughout his trial last week. We've published one of those notes in our paper today, only because it just shows you the brazen nature of him, that he is again making threats. I think I have it in front of me here, do I? Is that it? I'll just briefly show it to the camera. But he claims that there will be future attacks, and says he mentions a code word for our paper for any future attacks, south or north, by the CRG, the Criminal Revenge Group. Then he says a shooting in Donegal, device in Dublin, a petrol bombing in Sligo. A statement signed CRG. So he handed me that in the middle of his trial. I just didn't really know what to do with it. But I would say that Gardaí don't... Look, they took the threat seriously at the time when it came to Helen McEntee. They had to call to the address. Of course, all the protocols had to be followed. But I would be of the belief that Gardaí don't really take Mr. Murray particularly seriously. He makes these claims. Sometimes they've had to be investigated. He is a serious criminal. He's got serious convictions. But I think letters like this just shows you his mindset and his attitude.
How did you react, or what was your train of thought when he started making eyes at you in court?
Oh, I wasn't really surprised, to be honest, because of my previous interactions with him. I think he enjoys the notoriety, and in spite of the things that we've written about him, calling him evil and notorious and all of that, I think he possibly likes that, because and I think he liked the fact that I was there to cover his case. So it's quite strange and delusional. It's fascinating as a crime journalist to have that level of interaction and to be involved. But look, we're not on his side. We're not here to support Michael Murray, and we certainly have not painted him in any kind of a positive light just because he's given us the time of day. He is a ruthless, horrible criminal, and he will not be out of prison until he's in his 70s. You know, and it's rare that a criminal would be in prison for as long as he is, having, and he's not serving a life sentence. I mean, 35 plus years in prison, long, long time. He's a very serious criminal.
I'll just talk briefly about what I was approached, or eyes were made at me in a court case. It's a very, very bad court case. A young lady called Celine Conroy was beaten to death in Spain, in Elche, in near Alicante, 2002 maybe. Horrendous case, and a man caught her, his, I think it was her husband, yeah, Paul Hickey, was later convicted of it. But we went over, I think Jim Walpole and I went over for the case. It was in Elche in the court, and he was in court. It was a full murder trial, and he started winking over at me. So, what do you know, as a journalist, you're not there as a human being, you're not there as a normal person. So I thought, look, I saw an opening and I went for it. And I there was an intermediary, I won't say who was able to put me in contact with him. And he invited me, or he asked me to come to the prison. And he gave me a full interview. And he spoke about how he beat
Jesus Christ
in front of the kids. And it was when you look back, it was horrendous. Hearing a man talking about how he destroyed the life of a woman, and horrendous murder. But as a journalist, you go into work mode. I mean, I said this last week about Charlie Bird. You do go into work. I presume you were in work mode when Murray was talking to you. We're not there as people. We're there as journalists. And I always try to explain that to people, that this is our job and we have to have professionalism.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're not going to refuse opportunities to interview these people. That doesn't mean that we're their friends. And I think that they know that, you know. But are we going to turn away an opening, as you say? No, of course not. Any journalist would.
Of course not.
We've other topics to get into. You want to talk about Cove, obviously, and it is a sensational story. This, I was nearly going to call it a drugs bust, but no drugs have actually been recovered. Is that right?
Yes. So, no, it's not Cove. It's the Skibbereen area. So this was last week. It's amazing. You were mentioning how we heard about the death of Pierce McCauley. We're sitting there. It was last Thursday, I think, and somebody said something happening down in Cork. I think it's a drugs bust, but they haven't found any drugs yet. And then somebody came back to me and said, no, it's people trafficking. They found six people in a van and they're soaking wet, so they've just come off the boat. I was like, very good. My interest sort of waned a wee bit because I thought it was a big drugs bust. And then the person came back, no, it's drugs. It's a big cartel job and they're looking for the drugs. So this has been going on for a week. Tomorrow is Thursday, and these 10 people, six Spaniards, one Serb, two Dutch, and one Irish fella from the north, who's a lorry driver. Big, massive Garda operation. Essentially, Garda Drugs and Organised Crime Bureau and local Garda were involved in this huge operation because they became aware that these suspects were in the area. And the belief is that they were trying to land a cocaine consignment that would have been dropped off by the so-called mothership. We remember this from the MV Matthew last year. The MV Matthew was the mothership, and there was another small trawler that was supposed to bring the drugs ashore. It didn't happen, and the Army Ranger Wing stormed the MV Matthew. So the belief is the guards had intelligence that there was a ship coming from South America with it. Could be worth up to 1 billion. We don't know because they haven't found it, worth of cocaine. And it had been dropped overboard, marked with a buoy, with a GPS system, and the this alleged gang was on its way using divers to pick up the drugs. But something happened and they were spooked and it didn't happen. So there's a major operation underway to find the drugs, and there's a major investigation into these men. So they have been extended. They've been held under Section 50 of the Criminal Justice Act, which gives Gardaí a week. That time runs out on Thursday. So by the time this pod comes out, I think the guards will have got clarification from the DPP. Are they charged or are they released? But it's just another indication. We had the MV Matthew, we've had plenty of other cases. There is a belief now that Ireland is a weak link in the fight against drugs. In other words, the West Coast, we have one naval service ship out at a time with no primary radar. You know, Ireland is, for various reasons, Ireland's defence is quite weak. But it's not only defence, it's also security. So in other words, policing. And it is quite weak. And there is a belief that, you know, Mick O'Sullivan, the former Guard Assistant Commissioner and head of MAO, again, talks about the criminals using the line of least resistance. So if there's less security around the Irish economic zone or the Irish-controlled waters, does it not make sense that criminals are going to use that if they think there's much less chance of them being intercepted or caught here? So I think we have an international problem, I have to say.
Yeah, although, just to be devil's advocate, are these latest busts maybe an indication that Gardaí are finally cracking it? You know, I mean, that there's intelligence now coming in that they didn't have before, you know, that they have actually managed to catch these people in the act now. We're talking three different occasions. So, yeah, maybe we have been a weak link for some time, but perhaps there's intelligence now or a greater manpower looking into this. Do you know what I mean?
There's no doubt there's improved intelligence, and we know that there are Garda liaison officers around the world, including South America. But that's the sort of strategic side. But what about the operational side? That's the real issue. The guards can't, and the Naval Service and the Coast Guard cannot protect the whole of the coastline. That's the issue, that they can go to any cove. The plan here, if the intelligence is to believe, was to use an isolated pier. So our security is porous. And I think that's an issue from an international perspective. We do not want Ireland being seen as somewhere which is an easy mark for cartels. I think that would look very bad for Ireland internationally.
Absolutely. Well, we'll have to continue to watch that. There's no drugs recovered, and they think that at this stage they're not going to probably.
It's still possible. I mean, the Naval Service are involved, and they have a diving section. I presume they're looking around for it, but they're trying to get cooperation from the French and other authorities, because the mothership went somewhere. It isn't moored off the Irish coast, so they're looking for it. I would say, you know, if the drug dealers or the importers were smart, they would have discarded that and taken the hit, because who wants to be caught with that? Because that's a long time in prison. So look, it's probably unlikely, but I think they are still searching, and there is, as I say, a significant international investigation.
Fascinating. You know, I've just realised we haven't even come to the end of the pod yet, but there's so much that's happened in the last week and a half. It's crazy, isn't it? It's insane. And it's just the way it goes. Sometimes it's dead quiet, and then there's a bajillion things to discuss. We could have made about six pods out of this, so you're getting a bumper edition today, folks, for anyone who's still listening. I just want to mention a case that's it's important to me, like in covering it over the years. It kind of, some things, certain things you cover get in under your skin. This is one that just that has got in under my skin, and it is the unsolved murder of Kenneth Featherston. We put out a listen back podcast there earlier in the week to an interview I did with Kenneth's father, Brian, back in 2021. I've interviewed Brian for several years now, because it's a case that I just really believe should be solved. When you hear of unsolved murders, you know, there's a missing person or there's a lot of different facets to it that make it very difficult for Gardaí to solve. This is one that is that hopefully is solvable. There are suspects, there are people who have always been in the frame and suspected of killing this young father. And it's, I think it's just a matter of, and this isn't me knocking the guards, but it's just a matter of the previous investigation into the murder. You know, they took it as far as they could take it. Individuals were questioned, and the director of public prosecutions ultimately decided not to bring any charges against those people. This time around, you have the we call it the cold case unit, the serious crime review team, commenced a reinvestigation, a new investigation into the murder of Kenneth Featherston in 2020. Unfortunately, COVID hit, but here they are 4 years later, making a very significant arrest there on Bank Holiday Monday, which stunned everybody. No one saw it coming, including Ken's father, Brian, didn't see it coming at all. In fact, he actually thought, because he was about to meet with Gardaí, he actually thought he was going to be given bad news and told, look, we've taken it as far as we can and game over. But they have arrested, a man. He's since been released without charge. Some people might look that cynically and go, oh, so they don't have anything. Happens all the time. It means they now prepare a file that goes to the DPP, and the DPP decides whether there to be any charges, but they're preparing that file. So they've come towards the end of that investigation, and they have arrested a suspect. And that person is a businessman and is someone who has long been suspected of involvement in Ken's murder.
So just to explain, the arrest is the last phase of the investigation, because to do the arrest, or the reason for the arrest, is to put your evidence to the suspect. In other words, I put it to that X. So you're right, it is released without charge, but it is the caveat is a file for the DPP. So that's now, the guards have done their bit. I presume there's maybe a few odds and ends, and they'll send it off to DPP, who will decide. Let me ask you, why was he killed?
Well, I will say that I'm not an investigator, but we, you know, obviously have heard things over the years in terms of what Gardaí suspect and in terms of what Ken's family suspect. And there's a lot of information out there. Just in case anyone's not overly familiar, just to briefly surmise that Kenneth Featherston went missing in September of 2009, and his remains were then badly recovered remains were discovered in the Dublin Mountains in January 2010. So he's missing for that period of time before a dog walker came across his body. But he was basically, I have to be careful what I'm saying here, he was involved in a business enterprise with a number of individuals. He was a young dad of one, and basically was having a bit of a dispute or an issue with these people in terms of he wanted to exit the business. He had invested a sum of money into it, and he wanted to recuperate that money. I understand it was about 16,000 euro at the time. And he had had interactions with these individuals about getting that money back, and was told that business was slow and that they weren't doing any business and that they weren't able to give him the money. At some point, it's believed that Kenneth decided enough is enough. He wanted out. He didn't want to be involved with these people anymore. And he wanted to set up his own business with, he wanted to actually take over his father's business at the time. So it's believed that he went to a particular property in South Dublin, and he was murdered over this dispute of money. And his remains were discovered in the Dublin Mountains, as I said, several months later. Individuals were spoken to. Individuals have claimed that they've seen Kenneth in numerous different places at different times, and all of that has had to be investigated over the years as to his last movements and the last people to see him alive. And as I said, the person that has been arrested is someone that was known to Kenneth Featherston, and is a businessman, and was living out in the Midlands area of the country. Obviously Gardaí have arrested him, so they had reason to arrest him. That this is the second time that this person has been questioned in relation to Ken's murder.
And just one very quick point, Paul. A lot of people, no matter when there's a murder, they'll go, particularly of young men, it's always sort of no smoke without fire. He must have been up to something. There wasn't any smoke. There wasn't any fire. This man was not involved in criminality whatsoever. He was just doing his best.
Yeah, and that's something I really want to stress, like, and that Ken's family want to stress, you know, especially when you hear about money and looking for money owed, and people immediately think drugs are gangland or there's some sort of criminality there. Brian would say that his son was a bit foolish and would have lent money to anyone. And that's basically what happened. He had money from a compensation claim and he had lent money to people. Through this dispute with these people, he just wanted his money back, and it seems, or the suspicion is, and Gardaí suspect, he lost his life over that very simple dispute. But he was an ordinary father. He'd had a young child. She's now 18 years of age, or nearly 18 years of age, I think. He was an innocent victim, and I think Brian Featherstone and the family would feel no one is really going to believe that until they have their day in court, when this person, if this person is ever charged and it becomes a murder trial, they wanted all the facts to be heard in an open public forum. Because actually the most important thing to them is that Brian has said this, that his son's name is cleared. They really do feel that there's a perception out there that, as you said, no smoke without fire, that he somehow deserved it or whatever. I would say no matter the circumstances, no one deserves to be murdered. So if that's the line of thinking that some people have, well, that's still a disgrace. This is a man who was killed, and the persons responsible have not been brought to justice. So I ultimately think the motivation matters very little. But to Ken's family, I know it matters that it comes out in a public forum that he was just an innocent person whose life was taken from him. And so I hope that they get that justice. As I said, there's some cases that get in under your skin, and this is just one of them, because it seems like it should be solved, and I know that the Gardaí investigating it want to solve it, and that's why they opened up a new investigation 4 years ago, because there is a belief that this can be brought to a conclusion.
You're right, there are some cases that get under your skin. Maybe that's another day about the ones, you know, and anyway. All right,
that's us. Thanks as ever for listening. I think that's over nearly an hour long, so a bumper edition this week. We'll be back again next Thursday. As I said, we're going to try and do weekly pods every Thursday. So thanks very much for listening.
Thanks, everybody.